Good afternoon, Eric Samler, attorney registration number 32349 on behalf of Mr. Moore. I would like to spend my time today talking about two issues in the brief, the first two issues, which is what I call the defective Curtis advisement, and the second one being the juror issue. Pursuant to People v. Curtis, as we all know, a criminal defendant must be advised of five things: that he has the right to testify, that if he wants to testify, it's his choice and his choice alone, that if he testifies, the prosecution can cross-examine him, that if he's been convicted of a felony, the prosecution can ask about that, and that if the felony conviction is disclosed, the jury can consider it only for credibility purposes. We're not disputing that those five things were told to Mr. Moore. Here, however, there was an additional element that was thrown into the mix. He was told by the court that if he had a prior felony conviction, what would happen was that the prosecutor could ask if it was by plea or as a result of a trial. In People v. Gomez, this court held that the prosecutor may not ask whether a prior felony conviction arose from a plea or a trial. Therefore, just like in Gomez, the court's advisement here is just as defective.
Mr. Samler, I'd like to ask, other than Gomez, can you identify any case that has held that a trial court does not permit, commits error by allowing
Colorado,
a prosecutor?
No. In Colorado, no.
In any other jurisdiction?
Well, if I can get Gomez, I think there's like seven or eight cases. There's a couple of federal cases. I do not have those sites in front of me, but there are a number of jurisdictions that do hold that it's not relevant.
Well, it's not relevant, but in the same context as this case where the prosecutor wants to ask such a question on impeachment, let me just clarify, my understanding of those cases in Gomez is that they basically boil down to two contexts. One, where the defendant is arguing that for some reason a conviction by a guilty plea isn't proper for impeachment whatsoever, and the other, where the defendant is actually trying to put this evidence on as some sort of rehab and the trial court excludes it.
Okay. Regardless if there's cases out there, I don't know, I haven't read those cases out there, honestly, to say if that. But the fact of the matter is, it's still not relevant. It's still not relevant whether it was a trial, if it was a plea. And that's the bottom line. The bottom line is, it doesn't impact his credibility whatsoever, whether or not it was a trial or it was a plea. And it potentially throws into the mix other extraneous issues as to, you know, why did he plead. There's lots of things that might be going through a juror's mind as to why he pleaded or why he didn't plead. Then it comes into the question of, okay, if he went to trial, does he get penalized for actually exercising his constitutional right to go to trial? Does that go through a jury's mind? None of that stuff should come in because of the potential pitfalls that occur.
And is there any indication in the record that this actually affected this particular defendant's decision to testify or not testify?
Let's go there, because that's exactly where we need to go. For his decision, he must be known, voluntary, and intelligent. All three of those things must be met. Whether it affected or not is a voluntariness question. I don't think we even need to get there, because when he's given faulty information, when he's given information that these are what's going to happen when you testify, it's not known, because he doesn't know the full effect of what will or will not happen. He has to necessarily believe that, okay, that the judge, that he's going to be asked whether or not those were by plea or those were by trial.
What if he made the decision not to testify based on some other consideration? He just didn't want the jury to hear that he'd had a person with prior convictions. Under Blim, doesn't that require outside evidence?
Okay, here's my problem with that. If we have a remand hearing, where are we going with this? Since it's the prosecutor's burden to show that it was the waiver was knowingly voluntary and intelligent, does the prosecutor then get to call Mr. Moore to the stand and say, what did you talk about with your attorney? Don't we have a problem with attorney-client privilege? That's not been waived. This isn't a 35C sort of situation where you have ineffective assistance where there's a waiver of attorney-client privilege.
Does Blum not say that this is only appropriate in a 35C situation?
Is it only appropriate? It said in that situation it was brought up in a 35C. So I'm not sure if we can go there. Blum was not a direct appeal, if my reading of that's correct. And so I'm not sure if it needs to. If we need to look at whether or not it's defective or not, that's already before this court, and this court can make a legal decision whether or not it's defective. and whether or not it's knowing voluntary, I don't think we need to go there.
You agree that no objection was made in the lower court to the problem with the advisement?
I agree with that.
Normally, we would review for plain error.
Whether you review for plain error or not, I still think the error is plain, regardless.
Well, all right. On a pre-Gomez basis, the law was unsettled, correct?
Mm-hmm. That is correct.
And don't we apply, when the law is unsettled, don't we apply the law as it existed at the time, not as it's subsequently determined in later cases for purposes of plain error review?
Under O'Connell? It's a constitutional issue, I don't believe that's so. You know, if Mr. Moore gets the right to have applied to him all cases that were decided after the trial when they involve constitutional issues, he has the right to raise those issues. And those apply to him as long as his case is not final.
If they apply to him, but don't we still look at whether the law was unsettled in deciding whether the error was plain to the trial court at the time the trial court acted?
I see what you're getting, whether or not the trial court was incorrect in deciding whether or not it was by plea.
No, not just whether the trial court was incorrect, whether the trial court was so incorrect that it should have figured that out absent a contemporaneous objection. And it seems to me when the law is unsettled, the mm-hmm. question always gets decided in favor of the trial court.
Well, I will grant you that Gomez came out after the fact, and that was the first Colorado case that addressed that issue directly.
It's not a case that the U.S. Supreme Court has ever spoken to, and
not that I know of.
In fact, I mean, it's not even
I don't know if Curtis is really the minority rule in most jurisdictions out there anyway. So I don't know where that would come into play.
Ultimately, the content of the advisement isn't a federal constitutional issue, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, thank
that
you.
That is correct. Okay. If I may, I would like to jump over to the juror issue. And what I see as a juror issue, we are two separate but interrelated issues. That is, whether the juror violated the sequestration order and whether as a result of that violation, the juror was exposed to extraneous information. The sequestration order violation occurred when the juror was allowed her husband to discuss the case with her and did not extricate herself from the situation, simply stood there passively allowing her husband to read the article. The exposure to the extraneous information was the contents of the article itself. The issue then becomes is whether the extraneous information was improperly before the juror, and if yes, based on an objective, typical juror standard, whether the use of that extraneous information posed the reasonable possibility of prejudice to the defendant. To put it another way, the court must decide whether the information received through the violation might in the slightest way taint the verdict.
Isn't there an intervening question of credibility, much like the trial court makes credibility determinations in voir dire? I mean, here the juror testified that she wasn't paying any attention and she had no memory of hearing anything specific to the defendant about as her husband read the article. I mean, aren't we bound by the trial courts?
I don't think that's specifically what she said. She said she might not have heard it. She may not have heard anything else. She remembered specific things in the article. She remembered specific paragraphs in the article. With regard to the juror crying, the child said this, which was a paragraph before. Then what we have to do is say, okay, she didn't hear this. Then all of a sudden her mind turned on and she heard this. And then she didn't hear that, and she immediately tuned it out.
Isn't that a credibility question that ultimately the trial court has to make?
But the judge based it on her intent. If one reads what the judge didn't say that, okay, she wasn't exposed to this. I find she wasn't exposed to it. What the judge did was say she didn't intend to do anything. She intended to do the right thing because she didn't want her husband to know that she was on this case. So rather than telling him to please don't read that article to me or leave the room, she just stood there and let the article be read to her. So, you know, that there to me lies the real problem is what the judge looked at and says that, well, you know, she didn't mean it.
Are you saying that, assuming we agree with you, that she violated the sequestration order, that's per se requires her to be removed, or do we go the next step and look at the content of what she was exposed to by virtue?
You do need to look at the content. Of course you do. But if you look at the content here, what she was exposed to, the question becomes, if this stuff was introduced at trial directly, would it warrant reversal? If it was introduced at trial that Mr. Moore had prior felony convictions, if it was introduced at trial that he was facing a sentence of over 100 years, if that was introduced directly at trial, certainly that would warrant a conviction, warrant a reversal of the conviction. That's been taken. It's not a per se, rule. You have to look at what she was exposed to. And I think that if that last paragraph wasn't there, I probably wouldn't be up here arguing that issue. But the real problem is that last paragraph of the article. If anybody has any additional questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
May it please the court, Catherine Idala, registration number 39218, representing the people in this matter. I'll start with the Curtis advisement, and I think part of the disagreement over the standard of review for this issue comes from the fact that normally a defendant alleging a defect in the Curtis advisement raises the issue in a 35C. But here the defendant raised it on direct appeal, and it's an issue that he didn't object to below. So I think the standard of review should be plain error. And to give you an analogy, normally ineffective assistance of counsel claims are reviewed, or excuse me, are raised in 35Cs. And the only exception to that when a court will review it on direct appeal is when there's plain error. And here the defendant is basing his claim on a decision that came out after his trial. And the obviousness requirement of plain error requires that the law be clearly established at the time. And here, the trial court's advisement wasn't contrary to established law, so there is no plain error.
Sidala, you, in the answer brief, did not include a citation to Blum. In fact, you argued that this advisement could be considered on direct appeal. Do you have any response to whether we're bound by the Supreme Court's ruling in Blum on that?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, my reading of Blum, and correct me if you have a different reading of it, is that this type of Curtis advisement needs to be raised in a 35C proceeding because there's typically a need to have extraneous evidence about the waiver, the validity of the waiver. And I noticed that you did not include a discussion of Blum or a citation to that case. I was wondering what your position about the ruling in Blum is.
Well, I would agree with that, and I apologize for not including a citation. I did say that the standard of review should be plain error, but I think that sort of is the problem in this case, is that we don't have the additional factual development that would normally come with a 35C hearing. But just turning to the merits of what happened in this case, I think this court can conclude based on the existing record that the defendant's waiver of the right to testify was knowing, intelligent, and involuntary, excuse me, and unaffected by the trial court's addition to the Curtis advisement. Here we know that the defendant decided not to testify based on his attorney's advice because he told the court that. He said, and I quote, "I will do what my attorneys told me. I will not take the stand." And I don't think this information is irrelevant because defendants rely on their attorney's advice all the time. And I don't think that makes the decision any less theirs.
We don't know if the attorney's advice was the same as the apparently defective Curtis advisement that the trial court gave. So it could be that the attorney's advice was the same as what the court said. And so would that mean that the defendant's waiver was voluntary?
You know, I think under the circumstances here, we can conclude that the waiver was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. And I'm certainly not trying to suggest that the trial court could have said any number of outrageous and incorrect things in the Curtis advisement, and we don't care because the defendant already decided not to testify. But here we have a perfectly good Curtis advisement on the five required elements, and then the trial court added an additional detail on a, in my opinion, a fairly minor evidentiary matter where the law wasn't even settled. So this isn't an egregious Curtis advisement, and I think, you know, keep in mind, this defendant is a habitual criminal. He has three prior felony convictions, all obtained through guilty pleas. So as a part of the Rule 11 advisement in all of those cases, he's advised that a guilty plea has the same effect as a conviction at trial. So I think it's fair to deduce that the Curtis advisement here, that additional advisement that the court added didn't change the defendant's decision. And I think for that reason, this court doesn't need to remand on that issue. I think turning to the issue with the juror and the newspaper article, from my perspective, I think the defendant's analyzing this issue under the wrong legal test. Our Supreme Court, in a case is called Harper, set forth the test for dealing with the situation where a juror is exposed to media coverage during the trial. It's not the same situation where we're dealing with a juror exposed to extraneous information during deliberations. That test is different, and that I think the line of authority there is Weiser and Wadle and Harlan, and that the test there is a reasonable possibility of prejudice test. And here the test, when a juror is exposed to media coverage during the trial, the test is whether that juror was in fact prejudiced, and the trial court, you know, can conduct an inquiry of that juror to determine whether the juror was in fact prejudiced, not whether there's a reasonable possibility, hypothetically, that a juror could be prejudiced.
Mr. Samler's argued that the court's ruling actually focused on the juror's intent.
You know, I respectfully disagree with that. I think the juror followed the right procedure because it examined the juror to determine what she remembered from the article, so what she knew of the article, and then whether it would affect her ability to decide the case fairly. And just to go through the facts of the court's inquiry, the court said, and I quote, "Do you remember anything else in the article about the lawyers, for instance?" And the juror said, "No. To tell you the truth, I wasn't paying attention to him." "Do you remember anything from the article about the defendant?" "No." "Do you remember anything about the evidence except the 911 tape?" "No." And I think really what the defendant's asking you to do here is to second guess the trial court's judgment of the juror's responses, somehow that perhaps she wasn't being honest when she said she didn't remember anything. This is an abuse of discretion standard, and this court is simply not in a position to second guess the trial court's resolution of what the juror remembered from the article. And I think in addition to that, in addition to determining that she didn't remember anything, the court also asked several times whether the juror could be fair and impartial and put whatever she remembered out of this article out of her mind. And the court said, and I quote, due to your exposure to this article, do you believe that you are going to be a fair and impartial juror, or is it possible that you might remember something from the article that the other jurors have not heard? And the juror said, I can be fair and impartial. The court said, can you decide the case based only on the evidence you have heard from the courtroom? Yes, judge. And if you find yourself remembering something that the article might have said, for instance, would you be able to put it out of your mind if it wasn't presented to us in the courtroom? If you remember something about the article during deliberations, would you be able to say, I can't think about that because it wasn't given to us in court? The juror says, yes, I could. I wasn't paying much attention to him, what he was reading. And the court said, so would it be fair to say you didn't hear the whole thing? And she said, that would be fair. And I think, you know, the court's assessment of this juror's recollection of the article and her ability to decide the case fairly is really unassailable on appeal, because that was the court's decision and it was well within its discretion. I will rest on the brief on the habitual criminal issue unless this court has any questions about that. And just a brief comment about the sentencing issue.
I ask you a question about the habitual criminal.
Sure.
The defendant made an issue although I don't think there's any dispute that these documents were not created for purposes of this trial to prove a fact, but the contention is that the assembly of a set of documents is the same as creation of a document for purposes of the Melendez-Diaz analysis. Response to that?
I mean, I think that claim has been rejected. There are business records made in the regular course of business, and their compilation of them is doesn't make them any more created at this time. These documents are old. I mean, they were created at the time of the defendant's prior conviction, not in anticipation of trial. So I don't think any compilation of them makes them any more created at this time. And I disagree that this is at all comparable to the issue of the forensic chemist in the Melendez-Diaz case. And just briefly on the sentencing issue, it doesn't appear that the defendant takes issue with my resolution of the two burglary convictions, But I just want to speak briefly about the consecutive sentences for first-degree burglary and attempted murder. And I think the defendant's understanding of the Jewell and Muckle cases is incorrect. Those cases don't hold that consecutive sentences are improper if the crimes occurred in the same transaction. They say that consecutive sentences are improper where the crimes occurred in the same transaction and the evidence supporting them is identical. And the evidence is certainly not identical supporting these two convictions in this case. The two crimes don't even, protect against the same harm. Burglary is a property crime and attempted murder is obviously a crime against a person. The burglary crime, the evidence was that the defendant broke in to the victim's house in the middle of the night while she and her children were sleeping. And the assault attempted murder conviction was based on evidence that while she was laying defenseless on the ground, repeatedly stabbed her in the back and the neck. So I don't think those are remotely based on the same evidence. But if this court has any further questions, I request to affirm. Thank you.
Briefly on a few things. With regard to the sentencing, whether or not the burglary should run concurrent or consecutive, I believe it is the same evidence. What we need to look at is the fact that the burglary is a burglary with intent to assault. So there needs to be some evidence of the intent to assault. What's the proof of the intent to assault? But the assault itself. The same with the burglary with the intent to do serious bodily injury, it's the same thing. What's the proof of the intent to do serious bodily injury, but the serious bodily injury itself? And that, so I do believe in that case, that situation, it is, and they should run concurrently. With regard to the Curtis issue, the question of whether or not the advisement is a, we have a constitutional issue there. I think I misspoke, because the fact of the matter is that the defendant has a fundamental right to testify or not testify. And he has to be knowingly that waiver has to be knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. So the advisement of that, yes, it is. It does impact a constitutional right, just like any other waiver of a constitutional right has to be knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. So I do think that there is a constitutional right involved there, and that is perhaps why Colorado holds that right, obviously, in such a regard that they are in the minority of requiring this sort of advisement.
Okay, but so far as you know, the U.S. Supreme Court has not prescribed a litany that the advisement must follow.
Or there's any other court that has prescribed such a litany.
Okay, so that part of it isn't mandated by the federal Constitution.
No, that part, that you need to say X, Y, or Z.
You can't say A, B, and C. That's not a federal issue.
Well, an advisement period is not mandated by the federal Constitution. I understand that there's a constitutional right that it seeks to protect, but states that don't have this advisement aren't violating the federal Constitution, are they?
Probably not. I mean, my gut feeling anyway is that perhaps the court shouldn't be so involved in what the attorney says to the client and what advice is, and I think that's somewhat paternalistic of what Curtis is, quite frankly. But be that as it may, since Curtis is there, and that the question is whether or not it's knowing, voluntary, intelligent. Once you get that fact, then it has to be correctly explained. And if it's not knowing, if it's not intelligent, then we have an issue. And if it is knowing and intelligent, and the decision is whether or not it's voluntary, then how do we prove that without getting into what was said between counsel and client? And that certainly comes to a problem with regard to attorney-client privilege. It certainly comes to a problem with requiring perhaps Mr. Moore to testify and being called as a witness by the prosecution. Don't we have problems then with the Fifth Amendment forcing him to testify? So that's the issue here. And I just don't think that if it's wrong, if the advisement is incorrect, if the advisement says this is what's going to happen when it's not what's supposed to happen, then it can't be knowing and intelligent. And that's end of question. It's not knowing, voluntary, or intelligent. It's knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. If the court has nothing else. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.